Matthew 19 on divorce. The second talk about Jesus' teaching on Phariseeism was presented by Larry Barber on April 13, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I mentioned also last week that I had the opportunity to attend Gutenberg Summer Institute last year and look at our culture and look at how culture influences society, both from outside the culture and from within the culture as well. And we read a lot of books and discussed different sections in those books. We also had Bible studies, and this passage that I want to look at this morning is one of those passages. This is a passage that has always interested me. As a counselor, it's a question that comes up with people who are struggling in their marriages, and it's a difficult passage. Divorce is a painful and emotional issue, just in and of itself. And in this country, one out of every two marriages end in divorce. That does not exclude people who profess to be Christians, unfortunately. And that's a lot of people. That's a lot of pain. And all that emotion, all that pain comes to bear on how people feel about this passage, how they think about it, how they think about the issue, and actually how they think about what this passage really has to say. From the Jewish community of the first century to the Christians of our culture today, Christians and people have been debating this meaning of this passage and what Jesus was saying and how he was responding to the question of the Pharisees almost since the very moment that the words came out of his mouth. So in that kind of environment, that kind of debate, it's very difficult to know how to think about it. And it makes it even more difficult to know what this passage is saying because everybody has an opinion. At the heart of this ongoing dispute, there's discussion about how to interpret this particular passage. There's language here in this passage that's difficult to understand. There are subtleties in the interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees that are difficult to get a hold on. And so it's not an easy passage to interpret. What complicates all this is that you and I live in a subculture where we've been taught to look at the scriptures in a particular way. We've been taught to look at the scriptures with a particular set of lenses. I remember there's a bunch of us around here that attended a school down in the Bay Area, and I was involved in a singles ministry with one of the pastors there and had the opportunity to actually teach a couple times at a singles ministry, and the topic was relationships, and I got the opportunity to teach this passage, but it was all in the context of this. I mean, there were handouts that were handed out, and so it was really, there was this all this movement towards seeing this passage in a particular way, and I think that influenced how I looked at it, and I didn't know that at the time, but as I look back, I can see it. So it greatly influenced how I thought about it, and so it's real. However controversial and emotional this issue is of divorce, and we're going to look at that in this passage, we'll see that. What I really want to again look at this morning is not just the issue of divorce, but address something that's important and as problematic as the issue of divorce, and that is, again, this lenses that we have on as we look at not just the scriptures, but as we look at this particular issue and what the scriptures have to say about it. And this is the perspective. This is the set of lens that I think plays a role in how we look at things. What God wants from most of us is obedience. Consequently, God has laid out a set of principles, a set of standards of behavior in the Bible that we can learn from, we can read, we can see, in order that we might fulfill what God wants from us, what he desires from us, this fulfill this responsibility of obedience. The Bible then is kind of viewed as a handbook of sorts, a compilation of rules and behaviors, of principles given to us by God that sort of fit most situations. And sort of a parenthetical statement here is the idea that if God didn't think we could do this or fulfill this responsibility, then he wouldn't give us this set of behaviors to do, so he expects us to do it. He wouldn't ask us to do something we couldn't do. If I follow these instructions of the Bible, not only will I find favor with God, but God will bless me. He will bless my human experience. On the other hand, in contrast, if I do not follow these instructions, these set of behaviors, these principles, I will not experience joy, I will not experience happiness, I will not experience the blessings of God or all that God has designed for me. And this way of thinking is an aspect of the lenses that the Pharisees had on when they approached the Old Testament, and as particularly in this, we'll see today, I hope, in this issue. And I think it's also how many Christians approach the scriptures today, and that's part of what fascinates me about this passage, is because you see, I've seen it, and what I can communicate is that the same way of looking at the scriptures that the Pharisees had back when they're interacting with Jesus about this issue, it's the same way we often think about the scriptures as well, or approach them. Again, I hope to illustrate this point by looking at this passage. And it's not my intent to present a whole complete, exhaustive discussion on the issue of divorce. What I really want to look at is look at the interactions between Jesus and the Pharisees. And as a person who works with people and works with people in relationships, that kind of thing is very fascinating to me. And I enjoy trying to understand the process of what happens when people interact with each other. So it's a very fascinating passage. My intent here is to determine and help you look at what is in the minds of the Pharisees as they approach the scriptures, and look at the disparity between how Jesus is looking at the scriptures, how he understands them, how he thinks about it, in contrast to the Pharisees. And all the conclusions that we might have about divorce, or many evangelicals might have about divorce, may be different from what these Pharisees are thinking that are interacting with Jesus. The way in which many people approach the scriptures are the same. So that's kind of by way of introduction. Let's look at a little bit of historical background before we actually look at the passage. There's evidence that suggests that divorce was very common in Jesus' day. There were two predominant religious sects of that culture that were sort of the front runners of this debate about how to interpret Deuteronomy 24:1. This is the passage where Moses gave the command to write a woman a certificate of divorce. The more conservative Pharisees held that divorce was legitimate only for serious sexual offenses such as adultery. These Pharisees followed the teachings of Rabbi Shammai. On the other side of the debate, the more liberal Pharisees followed the teachings of Rabbi Hillel. And he taught that a husband could justifiably divorce his wife for almost any grievance, no matter how trivial, like if she burnt the toast, or she spilled food, or she talked too loud, or stuff like that, that a man could justifiably divorce his wife. And this was actually the more popular view held at the time. So with this background information, let's consider Matthew 19. Let's look at verses 1 through 2 to begin with. When Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Some of the Pharisees came to him, testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" So Matthew here points out that there was a whole bunch of people following Jesus, that he was healing them, and that it appears that Jesus is very popular. And in response to this popularity, some of the Pharisees that were there come up to Jesus and ask him what he thinks about this issue of divorce. And the question that they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? I suspect that the Pharisees who are asking this question are part of the more liberal persuasion. And I think we'll see that as we go along. Matthew comments that these Pharisees are testing Jesus. This is a fairly similar, familiar strategy for these guys. So they're not really interested. They're not coming to Jesus because they're really interested in what he has to say or what he thinks about the issue of divorce. They're pretty clear already what they think about the issue. They've already kind of constructed for themselves a theology of divorce based on their interpretation, based on how they looked in the scriptures. And according to their interpretation, a man, again, could divorce his wife when she displeased him and be justified before God because it was within the bounds of the law. It was according to the law. In asking this question, these men are reasonably confident that Jesus is going to respond with a more conservative perspective than their own. They believe that his opinion will be not only different than their own, but it will be go against the more popular view. There's a good chance that Jesus could kind of expose himself as sort of a rigid, uptight conservative. He could be, and in doing so, he could very well alienate himself from the popularity he has and from all the people following him, which in turn would, he could lose some popularity, but it would also put the Pharisees in a good light. I think this is the sort of their agenda that Matthew talks about, this testing Jesus. I think these men are really threatened by Jesus' popularity. They are used to people looking to them for the answers or how to think about things. It is uncomfortable for them to have these large crowds following Jesus. It kind of raises a sort of distant and faint doubt in their minds that creates kind of a level of anxiety that they're not comfortable with and that's very unfamiliar to them. It is not something that they really want to explore. It's something that they want to go away. And so they ask Jesus this question in a way of trapping him and testing him and exposing him and showing how different they are from him and how he goes against the popular view. It appears as though, on one hand, though, that they're interested in righteousness, they're interested in what Jesus has to say. I think it's more on the appearance level that they really want to, that they appear interested, or that they seem interested. But I think there's something going on altogether different. Notice the question that is being asked here by the Pharisees. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? In other words, what is a righteous reason for divorce, Jesus? Under what circumstance can I divorce my wife and still have God's good housekeeping stamp of approval? Under what circumstance can I divorce my wife and be righteous before God? What do you think, Jesus? That's the question that's being asked. The Pharisees want to be able to do what they want to do, and at the same time sort of pat themselves on the back or pat each other on the back and believe and think that they are doing the right thing. They are interested in thinking of themselves as righteous rather than actually pursuing righteous. And that their question really reflects that. So let's look at how Jesus responds in verse 4 through 6. And he answered them and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." It's interesting here that Jesus doesn't fall into the trap of getting into a debate about divorce or how to interpret this particular question. He doesn't really answer their question in the way that they expected him to. His response reminds the Pharisees of the scriptures. He takes them back to the beginning, back to Genesis, the first chapters of Genesis, and he reminds them that God is the author of marriage. So rather than getting into a debate about divorce, he talks about marriage. And he reminds them that as God is the author of marriage, no man really has the authority to stop that or end that. He reminds them that God's intent in creating the marriage relationship was that separate individuals, through commitment, would become one. And consequently, divorce was not a part of God's original design. And in fact, it actually is contrary to God's purpose for marriage. This was not how the Pharisees were thinking about marriage. They were thinking about marriage as they were looking at for a way to get out. And what Jesus is saying to them, God's intent was that for two people to become one, and divorce was not a part of the original design of God. In responding to this question the way he does then, Jesus exposes the Pharisees' claim to be interested in righteousness as a facade. This was a hotly debated issue, and there were many scriptural references that spoke of marriage and God's perspective on it and his perspective on divorce. If it was righteousness with respect to marriage and divorce that the Pharisees were interested in, they would not have been testing Jesus. And this is not the question that they would have asked. And Jesus exposes that. The truth is that the Pharisees were not interested in the scriptures except to utilize them as a means of justifying themselves. The scriptures were interpreted to justify their behavior, not to discover what God thought on the matter. So they're coming to Jesus, trapping him, asking this question, how can I be righteous? How can I do what I want to do and pat myself on the back and see myself as righteous at the same time? How can I do that? That's their agenda. And Jesus exposes them as not really understanding God's perspective. He exposes they're just using the scriptures to see themselves, to interpret them in such a way as to see themselves as righteous. Well, obviously, when you get exposed, you feel sort of defensive, and that's exactly how the Pharisees respond to this indictment. Look in verse 7. They said to him, Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? This is like ultimate name dropping here. In other words, if what you're saying is true, Jesus, then why did Moses, if what you're saying about marriage, if what you're saying about how God sees things, Jesus, then why did Moses command men to give the woman a certificate of divorce and send her away? You're wrong, Jesus, because Moses made provision whereby a man could legitimately divorce his wife. Moses, Jesus, of all people, Moses, you're going up against him. This is what he says, Jesus. Explain that, Jesus. That's kind of the feel of how they're reacting to Jesus. What is most interesting here is how the Pharisees do not respond to Jesus. They respond very defensively. They're not interested in the possibility that they could be wrong. They're not open to hearing a different perspective or hearing the truth. Rather, they respond defensively to Jesus by referencing Moses. They were not asking the question, what possible reason could there be for divorce? They were asking the question, how can I divorce my wife and be justified? That's a very different question. Jesus responds to their defensiveness in verse 8. He says to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning, it has not been this way. And this is a source I discovered in, actually, I think it was an Erdman's Bible Encyclopedia, and I like to read that. Historically, Jewish marriage was a legal contract binding a man and a woman and their families to perform certain social prescribed roles. The contract covered the lifetime of the contracting parties. The male, however, had the right of preparing a bill of, quote, a bill of divorcement, and thereby terminating the legal arrangement. In Jewish culture, a woman could not legally divorce her husband. A certificate of divorce was a legal document given to the wife for the purpose of protecting her from the widespread abusiveness that had been a problem and to provide her with a safeguard from the suffering which divorce caused. According to Jesus, Moses' motivation for giving this command was because of the hardness of heart. Moses understood that divorce was a tragic reality of human experience due to the nature and reality of human sinfulness. Moses responded to this reality by permitting you to divorce your wife. Granting a wife certificate, the wife a certificate of divorce was a concession to the sinfulness of man. It was not what God intended from the beginning, and it was not intended to be a justification for divorce. Jesus' answer here directly exposes the hard-heartedness of the Pharisees in applying Moses' command. They had missed the point. Ironically, the Pharisees have applied a legal document that was permitted by Moses from the consequences of divorce to the purpose of morally justifying their divorcing their wives. The very law that Moses gave because of sin was the very law that these Pharisees were using to justify sin. Jesus concludes his remark in this section to the Pharisees when he says, in verse 9, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." Okay, this is where it gets really sticky in this passage. And this is a difficult and often misunderstood verse. And it's, at the heart of what's the controversy. So I want to take it sort of one step at a time so we can understand what's going on here. So let's look at this phrase, "and I say to you." So Jesus and the Pharisees have been interacting with each other about this issue. They come to Jesus, they ask him the question, Jesus responds, they kind of have this back and forth dialogue. Jesus now turns directly to them and says, "Okay, here, this is what I'm saying, I'm talking to you." So it's a kind of way of emphasizing, I'm directing this at you, and this is important what I'm going to say. So what he says, or what he's about to say to them, pertains directly to them, and it kind of comes out of this conversation that they've been having with each other. So if we're going to understand what Jesus is really getting at here, we need to understand what he's saying specifically and directly to the Pharisees. Okay. Secondly, in the context of this interaction, Jesus has been talking to the Pharisees regarding their faulty attitude about marriage and divorce. They have this practice of approaching marriage looking for a way out from that which was never intended to have a way out. They believe that if they simply follow Moses' prescription by granting their wives their certificate of divorce, they can justifiably divorce their wives for any reason at all. So this is the context of what in which Jesus says what he says. The immediate context of verse 8 and 9, which is where you see this, "I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery," that's the immediate response to this interaction. So he's responding to their defensiveness in verse 7. Verse 8 and 9 is a response to the defensiveness of the Pharisees in verse 7. Next, the term "commits adultery," I think, is better translated "adulterated her," or "you have made her a victim of adultery." So the verse should read, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another makes her a victim of adultery." Jesus is making a direct connection here between the serial monogamy of the Pharisees, who justify divorcing their wives in order to marry another woman, and a person who commits adultery. He's making this connection between the two. And in making this connection, it's important to understand that Jesus is not redefining a biblical definition of adultery. He is stating in very dramatic terms that the same sinful desire at the heart of the practice of the Pharisees is the same sinful desire that is at the heart of adultery. That's the connection that he's making here. According to Jesus, he who divorces his wife and marries another, like the practice of the Pharisees, okay, that's important, like the practice of the Pharisees, and he who commits adultery are essentially doing the same thing. A legal certificate permitted because of hardness of man's heart cannot make something evil into something good or something justifiable. It's also important here to note that Jesus is not saying to the Pharisees, you know, by the way, your interpretation of the law is just, it's wrong, it's not right, it's incorrect. He is saying directly to them that your practice of self-justifying divorce amounts to adultery. That's what he's saying to them. Okay, and if we understand what he's saying about marriage and divorce, then we have to understand what's going on between, again, the Pharisees and Jesus and their interaction with each other. It's interesting, the disciples have been listening to this whole conversation. They've been watching, listening intently, and they respond in verse 10. I only have part of that verse here, so I'm going to read the whole thing. And the disciples said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. But he said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men. And there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom. He is able to accept this, let him accept this. What is most striking about how the disciples respond to Jesus is the contrast between, again, how they respond to Jesus and how the Pharisees respond to Jesus. The disciples have heard and understood Jesus to be saying something very significant. They've been considering the weight of his words as he's interacted with the Pharisees. And unlike the Pharisees, they understand the seriousness of marriage and from Jesus' perspective. Marriage is about being a particular kind of person. Unlike the Pharisees, his explanation of the scriptures has brought them home to them the recognition of their own brokenness. They are humbled in their response to his words. They get it. They understand how hard marriage is and what Jesus is saying about marriage and what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees about their attitude. And they understand that marriage is difficult, and they're saying, if that's the way it is, then why should we? Let's not get married because it's too hard. They don't understand Jesus to be giving us this new law. Oh, the Pharisees were wrong, or how they thought about it was wrong. And here's the new law. If somebody can get a divorce justifiably if there's adultery. That's not the point. The point is that Jesus has this interaction with the Pharisees, and he's confronting them about their practice of entering into marriage and sort of looking for a way out of it. That's sort of the way they go into it. And he's confronting them. That's what's going on, and that's what Jesus is confronting. Okay, let me make a couple closing comments here. And God has not changed his mind about divorce. The same perspective has been communicated in both the Old and New Testaments. Divorce is a tragic reality of human experience due to the nature and reality of our human sinfulness. And because human beings are unalterably sinful, it's possible that we can destroy the very relationship that is closest to us. What we learn from Matthew 19 and Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees is not intended to be an explanation of a new law. It was an explanation of how divorce is clearly and unmistakably a symptom of evil in the human heart, and that this is not God's intent from the beginning. Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees, we need to take seriously on two levels. First, it's easy to see how the Pharisees got it wrong. They wanted to see themselves as doing it right. And so that approach in the way they looked at the scriptures, they brought that with them. They made up rules so that they could do it right. And that influenced how they saw the scriptures. We ought to learn from that in the sense that how easy it is to blind ourselves to what's true about ourselves. It's easy for us to focus on what we think we do right rather than look at what we do wrong. It's very difficult being a Christian, I think. I think it's actually harder to be a believer than it is to be a non-believer, because you live with this tension of you have God working in your heart and moving you to want to do what's right on one hand and see what's right, but then you have this problem of sin that exists. And there's this almost schizophrenic experience where you want to do the right thing and you don't do the right thing. And it's a very difficult and painful place to live. So if you can make up a bunch of rules that actually fall way short of what God expects or wants from us, you can feel sort of better about life and yourself. And it's a very tempting thing to do. And it's what these Pharisees did here. And it's what historically what Christians have done all through the ages. So when we find ourselves justifying our behavior, we must remind ourselves that as morally broken and fallen people, we're on pretty shaky ground, according to what the Bible is saying about us. And we must respond to this tendency towards self-justifyingness and repudiate it. Secondly, we must let the Bible be the Bible and be the authority in and of itself. We must let it speak to us just as it is. We must not be seduced into changing into a manageable set of rules so that we can avoid the discomfort of discovering how fallen and broken we are. And finally, given the nature of our moral brokenness, when divorce happens, I think this is really helpful here, that when divorce happens, no one can stand back and say, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, it wasn't my fault. The nature of divorce is such that as according to what Jesus is saying here, is that the sinfulness of the human heart is at work, and that's the cause for divorce. And that's true of all of us. So I'll take some questions.
Larry, you mentioned hardness of heart.
Where are you?
Back here.
Okay.
Could you talk a little bit about what that looks like in a relationship?
Could I talk about what hardness of heart looks like in a relationship?
Yeah, could you define that a little bit?
Okay. I'll do that a little bit, but I think what we all who are in relationships know what we're talking about here. The tendency towards self-protection, the tendency towards to see myself as being right at the expense of putting others wrong, the tendency towards hiding from the truth about myself, and that plays itself out in relationships where my need to be right or to see myself be it right, at the expense of other people, at the expense of people who I profess to care about. You all know what we're talking about here? This rebelliousness in our heart? This defensiveness against the truth about ourselves? I mean, how do you respond when someone tells you that you are wrong? You sort of move towards them with open arms and say, sure, yeah, right. Is that what you do? You know, I find with most in when Christine and I have conflict, and in the conflicts that I work with couples, most of what it's about is who's at fault, who's right, who's wrong, and who's in control. That's what most of it's about. The issue is none of us are right, none of us are in control. Margaret.
When you, your last comment about people, if divorce happens, nobody's in a position to be able to say, well, it's not my fault.
Right.
My first thought of that is...
Let me say that clearly, more clearly.
Okay.
It's not that no one's at fault, or like it's that I can't stand back and say, you're the whole problem, nothing but the problem, the whole problem, and I don't have any problems at all. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not sure that that I agree with you. I'm sure I agree with you in the sense that I'm not sure it's ever useful or technically correct to say, I have no responsibility here. Right. But one of the things that popped into my head was if I were talking to somebody who was getting out of a massively abusive relationship, that's not the first thing I would say to this person. Granted, nobody's not a sinner, but some people have. I've been witness to some relationships where the abuse is hellacious, and it seems like just beating this person up. I mean, if the person's going to say, you know, I have no responsibility in this, it's all his or her problem. Maybe I'll say that, but when somebody's getting out of a relationship where they have really been, I mean, obviously and seriously abused, I don't know how useful it is to beat them up further by saying, you know, you've got some responsibility here too. I just can't see how somebody could be responsible, or a lot of these people that I'm thinking of could be responsible for the fact that their husband beat them and raped them, or their wife was just had a tongue in her like a serpent, and the poor guy is just dying from being emotionally abused. So I was just wondering if you'd comment on that.
Okay. Well, let me say two things. One is this passage is specifically dealing with this particular problem with the Pharisees of they're going and approaching marriage looking for a way out and justifying it and looking and interpreting the scriptures in such a way that that would provide them with that kind of justification. And that's really the problem that Jesus is taking on here. So it's really this, Jesus is really focused on them and their thinking and perspective, okay? This passage isn't really dealing with that issue of a bad marriage, okay? You're right. It's difficult. It's not even appropriate at times to say to a person, whether it's a man or a woman, who comes into you and says, or who are divorced, and say right up front to say, well, what did you do, or what's your part, or that's not helpful right up at front. Divorce is a very painful thing. It is. This is the person who has known you more intimately than anyone else, and they're rejecting you. That's the nature of divorce. They're saying you're bad in a very profound way, or that you're not worth being with or loving. That's a very, very painful thing. And then all the circumstances that can be involved in how that gets communicated. So it's a very painful thing. So it's not, I mean, you're right, it's not appropriate to say that right up front. And I'm not going to get into what is appropriate because it's different with every single person and every single situation. But at some point, there is a tendency in our culture, particularly, I think, for the people to see themselves as victims and nothing but victims. That is a huge problem, okay? But at some point, it is very helpful to... It's a very difficult thing to do because particularly like in the case of an affair, there is this perspective that there is a good guy and there is a bad guy, and it's like as far apart as you can get and never the two shall meet kind of thing. And that's just simply not true. That isn't to say that someone who has an affair isn't wrong and it's horrible and it's non-justifiable. But there's also it can be very helpful to help people see, okay, what was going on in this relationship that this happened? That doesn't mean that you're responsible for what this person did or that they're responsible for you. But let's say there's a divorce. What do you want to learn about yourself and about reality and about truth from this situation? So that you don't go down the road and end up doing the same thing again, or the same thing doesn't happen, or you don't play the same part. So I think the scriptures are very clear about wanting us to continually look at ourselves and understand what's true about ourselves, what's true about God, what's true about reality. And so I think that can be very helpful to people at some point in the process. Logan?
I thought it was interesting how you contrasted the two teachers, rabbis' views on divorce.
Right.
Because that explains, I think, why then they throw this Moses thing at him.
Yes.
Okay, so we can't get you to take a side and then therefore divide the crowd. You'll lose half the crowd if you pick a side here.
Right. Well, he doesn't take a side.
And then they say, okay.
He just nails them.
What about Moses? Well, if you read it,
right.
Moses never told them to get divorced.
That's correct.
And Moses never granted them writs of divorce.
Right.
He just said.
That's right.
He did say that if you commit adultery, you should be stoned.
Yeah.
And if you marry and it turns out you're not a virgin, you can be stoned. And he said a lot of things, but he never said, oh, go ahead and divorce.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is that this is the passage that they come to Jesus with,
mm-hmm.
in terms of defending their position. Because, again, this was Moses wasn't saying it's okay to get a divorce. He was saying give the woman a certificate of divorce so that she's protected.
Yeah.
So this legal document was used as a means of morally justifying divorce. Now that's kind of a sick twist.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to be doing some pretty serious mental gymnastics in your mind to go from Sarah.
I'll try and figure this out as I say it, but it seems like kind of what you were saying in the beginning and in general here is that the Pharisees are asking the wrong question, that they're seeking a way to justify themselves versus saying, how do I seek goodness and to preserve this thing that God created.
That's a good way of putting it.
Well, in that same vein, it seems like I have this sense of like this ideal world where nobody justifies themselves. But then we seem like we're just kind of these puddles of nothing. You know, you get into a conflict and you instantly say, well, I need to understand myself here. And there's no assertion of self. And so, I mean, it seems like there's a way in which in wanting goodness and truth and how to preserve a relationship or something good, you still could be justifying something. I guess you see my fine line of...
Maybe trying to justify truth, or maybe trying to figure out what's really true.
But can be easily perverted to defensiveness or offensive.
Absolutely.
Do you have any...
We're very sophisticated.
...wisdom about how to navigate that?
Or? We're really good at it.
Okay.
I don't know if Sarah sort of clicked something in my mind. I don't know what you all have come to believe about this passage, but traditionally it is interpreted as, okay, there's this old way of thinking about divorce. People are wrong. And then this passage is really seen as this is the key passage in the New Testament that's looked upon to say, okay, this is the new law about... Andrew? I don't think you're on. Nope.
Am I on? Really in front of our face. And
that's true.
And then I wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying about Margaret's comment. Are you essentially saying that that becoming a victim or being mistreated is not an excuse for avoiding self-exploration or self-understanding?
Yes.
That's essentially what you're saying, is
yes.
It right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
That's essentially what I'm saying, that's what we're called to.
Okay.
As we live life, as, life is the stage, if you will, where God works in our lives, mm-hmm. and helps us see what's true about Him and ourselves and other people. And that should be an ongoing process.
Yeah, in fact, what's done to us is the fodder for self-exploration,
exactly.
Oftentimes.
Yes, yeah. What our experiences are, yes. I think Catherine had her hand raised, is that right?
My question is about your comment regarding the pseudo-schizophrenia that we all experience when we're having a Romans 7
yes.
experience about,
yes.
You know, Paul saying, for the good that I do, what is he saying here? For the good that I will to do, I do not do, but the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Mm-hmm. So what, I guess I'm wondering, what is the bridge between, you know, having that understanding of what's right and making that choice and doing what we will not to do? There's something that bridges the two so that we can live, you know, in God's grace. And I'm wondering what's the barrier in our minds or hearts that keeps us from being at peace with those two? Because, you know, living in one is like, I mean, when you live in such a way where you're trying to fulfill some, like you said, a list of rules, where we kind of translate the Bible in such a way that, you know, we can live and feel okay about ourselves and not move toward truth, or living in a way where we never satisfy what God might be asking of us and live with self-condemnation all the time. There's some bridge between the two, and I'm wondering what that might be. Does that make sense?
I think so. I'm going to try, and if I don't get at it, you can tell me, okay?
Okay.
I think the bridge is, there's a certain comfort that comes from, comfort is certainly part of it. But there's other aspects to it too, like, I have this saying that I tell people sometimes, and I'm not going to say it exactly the way that I tell it because it's not appropriate here, but that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free.
It's probably appropriate.
And after it kicks the heck out of you, okay? That happens. Truth is harsh and it's hard and it's painful because it's not how we really want to see ourselves. But there's also a sense of comfort that comes with it, a sense of this is right feeling or perspective. This is good. So I think that's part of the bridge. But I also think it's kind of what I was getting at last week, in that I believe that a church, I mean, it's not just you having this experience. It's all of us. This is for those who God has done the miracle of giving them eyes to see and giving them a desire to do the right thing and open their eyes to see what the right thing to do is. This is the miracle. This is the miracle that Paul describes in his conversion in 2 Corinthians 5. That's the real miracle, that we even see it, that we want it. And then we find ourselves failing miserably. And so we come to recognize our need for mercy. That's the kind of eternal perspective that God is trying to create in us. And that's a really good thing. I think that's what's supposed to happen in church, is that we come here and we listen to the truth. We get reminded of what's true because we so easily miss it or lose perspective. And we're here with each other and we're all saying, yeah, this schizophrenic experience, that's what it's like. And so we're not alone in it. That's what Bonhoeffer was getting at when I read that passage from Bonhoeffer last week about it is an indication of God's grace that it's messy, that we all have this, live in the community when we're having these schizophrenic experiences. It's the way it is. It's real. So I guess that's the bridge. It's real.
So you think having a willingness of heart to admit that we have that, because I might be wrong, but I don't think I am, in that in many organizations, religious organizations,
yeah,
people walk around pretending like there is no such thing and they have it all together.
Right.
And then
right,
everybody walks alone around like islands,
yeah,
thinking like they're the only schizophrenic person, you know, in the congregation.
I think it's fairly safe. I mean, I don't want to get into us-them thing again. But
no, I'm not saying we're exempt from that. I'm just wondering, making a generalization that could that be part of the wall that keeps people isolated, you know,
absolutely,
that unwillingness
absolutely
to admit it.
And you kind of have to catch it. You kind of have to catch and see the, and recognize the value of it. It's not something I could stand up here and say, yeah, this is a really good thing. We ought to be open with each other. But you gotta experience and see it and value it for yourself. And it happens here. There are people here who think that there are people who are more together than they are, and that's not true, but they still believe it. We have to stop.
All right.
Brian, one more.
I was fascinated by the disciples' response.
Oh, man.
And that, to me, is so big because apparently at that time in history, you don't have to go along on this, but nobody even thought this way about that it's a permanent Genesis-style marriage, as Jack has taught in his Marriage and Family. And I was going to ask you if even in the secular, world today, and maybe for the last few centuries, how that even the world is sort of that they have this ideal of a permanent relationship, that they are more enlightened, you might say, historically than what was going on here.
Yeah. I want to comment about the disciples really quick. It's like, it's amazing because, I mean, part of what we were looking at in that seminar last week or last summer was this just the pressure, the cultural pressure to conform. And they're sitting here listening to Jesus have this interaction with these Pharisees who are the established order. They are the authority. And the pressure for everyone to sort of see reality the way they see it. And they're watching Jesus interact here with these guys. And as they listen to Jesus, the lights are going off. It's like, oh, yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Oh, yeah. And then they get it. And then they respond to Jesus, well, if this is the way it is, then holy cow, we're in trouble. Let's be eunuchs. That's pretty radical. That's pretty drastic. So we got Easter next week, and Jack's, I don't know who's doing Easter or what's happening Easter, but then I'll be back the last week of April. Thank you very much.